philosophical perspective, Buddhism is the middle way. The Eightfold Path is between the two extremes of complete hedonistic, sensual enjoyment and practice, right the way through to full asceticism. So the Buddha tried both. When he was a prince in his lay life, he had every sensual pleasure that could be afforded to him. His father made sure that he had it because his father didn't want him to become a recluse. And then when the Buddha finally realized that there was more to life than just sensual pleasure, he decided to set off and become a recluse to find the meaning of life. And then he practiced to such extremes that he put his both mind and body through physical hardships, and found that that didn't lead to emancipation, that life was still suffering, that there was still something else. And he had to come back and start to put some strength in his body and refocus his mind and actually understand the nature of sensual pleasure. And when he understood the nature of sensual pleasure, then he realized that everything, all suffering was caused by craving, and the elimination of craving was the elimination of suffering. And at that moment he became enlightened. But he had to balance that because he'd seen both extremes. And so does Buddhism have, is there a question of balance in Buddhism? Absolutely. It's the middle way. It's right on the focal, the focus, the focal point, the fulcrum.
Is that in any way conflict by making no decision, seeing in the middle, and being a person that doesn't commit themselves one way or another, and if you're ever seeing in the middle?
There's a sutta where the Lord Buddha talks about that actually. And he says that that in itself is wrong view.
Yeah, I thought there'd be balance, the balance story.
Yeah, I can't remember all of the details of that, but that's actually one aspect of wrong view. Because it's non-committal.
Procrastinating.
Yeah, and the Lord Buddha really taught that you should put in effort, but you should put in effort with right view. That's understanding the right view of the world. So the right view, depending as to which scriptures you actually read, will be something that I explained a few weeks ago, which is to understand what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. To understand the Four Noble Truths, the suffering, the cause of suffering, the emancipation from suffering, and the path that leads there, and also the four nutrients, which are nutrients that feed the body, nutrients that feed the mind, which is a food, and excuse me, the ayatana, the senses, sankhara, the karma, which feeds rebirth and rebirth consciousness, those four things, and also what they call paticca-samuppada, which is the doctrine of dependent origination, which is talks about how ignorance is the cause of all things and causes birth, causes karma, and causes rebirth. So if you understand right view, then you practice to understand those things. You have to put in effort. So procrastinating and saying, well, I don't know whether that's right or I don't know whether that's wrong, it's not the way to go, not a valid practice. So, and the Lord Buddha actually said that. There's a sutta which talks about what is eternalism and what is different wrong views of the world, and it's somewhere in there. I can't remember what... the Brahmajala or something like that. I can't remember what it is. But yes. So making or being indecisive or evasive in terms of philosophy, if you like, or in terms of what course of action to take or what's wholesome, what's not wholesome, that's not an acceptable practice, if you like. It doesn't get you anywhere. It's a wrong view. So taking the middle path means more than that. That would be a wrong understanding of what is the middle way. That's a dead end, making no decision. So, now I've rattled on, that's the talk, so we'll, we can start. So,
this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
It might have been another gun. Anyway. I prefer the mic to have. And I get to choose, so. So, what do we talk about?
Can I have another question?
Hey, you may. Yeah, absolutely.
We talked briefly about balance, and then how that balance has to be balanced with the overall picture, but what happens when you get a situation where people practice the wrong thing, and they practice it so much that they get entrenched to it by they think that that's the only right way, and you got to break that thought pattern or process, and it's so hard because you've practiced it so much that...
It's a really good question, actually, because meditators who have no teacher can fall into traps. I've heard people say, oh, my teacher's the Buddha. Well, I'd like to be able to talk to the Buddha. That would be a real honour. But unfortunately, he died many thousands of years ago. So it's really, when you read the suttas, they give you a lot of guidance, but they're not the be-all and end-all when it comes to your own personal development, because they are quite generic. Even though the Buddha was extremely careful and taught the same thing in many different ways so that different individuals with different personalities and different tendencies can understand the same thing but come at it from a different angle. It's still very useful, especially for those people who are reasonably advanced in their meditation, to have someone who's a guide, someone who's been there before them and experience some of the things that they're starting to experience. Because if you're not in that situation, you can do exactly what you're saying. You can find yourself trapped. I was talking to someone recently who asked me some advice some time ago, which I gave to them. And they came and asked me again about their own meditation. And that particular person is going to, if they're not careful, going to go down a dead end in their meditation. But it's an enjoyable dead end, and it's very difficult for them to withdraw and do something else. When I was a monk and translated for Ajahn Thet, there was a Westerner who'd known Ajahn Thet even longer than me. He'd been to see him several times as a layperson. And he was very, his meditation, his concentration was extremely good. And he was what we would call a natural samadhi type. He could close his eyes and within a short period of time, he'd be in deep state of concentration. But Telajan Ted would always say to him, stop doing it. Come back and investigate. Don't just enjoy the bliss and enjoy the setting, because you won't get enlightened that way. You won't learn. And he'd say, well, you know, I'm trying. And Telajan Ted would say, well, it's no good. You have to stop doing that. And you have to start looking. Take something like the body and examine it. Something that's coarse. Something that's not as blissful as deep concentration. And look at it from the point of view of being impermanent, of being suffering, of being not self, uncontrollable, beyond control. And he'd say, oh, yeah, because I'd be there translating for him. And he'd say, oh, yeah, I'll do that, yeah. And so after a few days, I'd say to him, and how's your practice going? Oh, well, yeah, look, I tried doing that. Look, so you haven't actually done it. Well, no, I gave it a go, and now I'm back into just enjoy this deep state of concentration. And so even though Telajan Thet was an extremely good teacher, even he couldn't get this person to change his ways. And Telajan said, if you're not careful, you'll have trouble. And sure enough, a few years later, he had a mental breakdown. He had a mental breakdown. He completely changed his... He went on holiday with some friends, and something happened, I'm not quite sure what, but he had a complete breakdown. He came away with a completely new name, new personality. He was just totally different, just a different personality. Overnight, he changed and never went back to being the way that he was. But he was a natural samadhi type. He could just go into deep concentration and he would have all sorts of different experiences. And so, yes, you know, you can get to the stage where you're practicing incorrectly, because you have to understand that when you talk about samadhi or right concentration, right meditation, if you like, it has to be associated with right view, which I've just explained, right? Those four things of right view, unwholesome, wholesome, excuse me, four noble truths, four nutrients, and bodhicitta-samabhada. If you don't practice meditation with that as a foundation, then it's not right meditation. You can have people who have very strong concentration and they can enter what we call jhana, which is full absorption, where you don't see the outside world at all. You don't hear, you don't see. I can talk a little bit about that. But that won't lead to enlightenment. But it does lead to blissful states. And depending as to which jhana level of concentration you're in, which jhana you're in, corresponds to different heavenly realms. So you can actually have psychic experiences or all sorts of experiences when you're in jhana. But it won't lead to freedom from suffering. Because when you come out of that state, suffering is still there. In that state, there's still the potential for suffering. It's hidden. It's like potential energy, you know. It's there. It's locked away. But the defilements don't go. They're only in abeyance. They're just waiting for you to come out of that state before they start up again. So it's a very pure state, and the mind's extremely still, but it's not the way to freedom from suffering. To be free from suffering, you have to forego that state, or at least use it. You use it to make your mind calm. And then when you come out of that state, then you turn your attention to whatever your meditation subject is, and you turn your attention and look at the meditation subject, whether it's the breath or the four elements or whatever it may be, from the point of view of being impermanent, being suffering, and not self. I repeat again, impermanent, suffering, and not self. If you could understand what those three things are, job done, basically. That's what meditation is. That's what freedom from suffering is. It's understanding those things and how they relate to the outside world, how they relate to the world which I spoke about yesterday for those who were here, which is the world of the conventional world, which we talk about things like table, chair, we give names to things, we talk about things in a conventional way, but it's not the absolute reality. In the absolute reality is what we call Paramatta Dhamma. And Paramatta Dhamma is not a suburb of Sydney. Paramatta Dhamma is the highest Dhamma. And the four things that consists of are the building blocks that build reality. So we look at the conventional world, the world of what in Pali, the world of Samuti. And we have relationships with people, mother, father, and all of that sort of thing. And we live a normal life. We all go to work. We all earn money. We all spend, go shopping. We eat, we drink, we do things to survive. That's all what is the normal world. That's a world driven by ignorance. It's a world driven by defilement, greed, hatred, and delusion. The real world, when you come to analyze it, is something else. The pinnacle of truth is that there are a number of building blocks which go to make up mind and body. And the Buddha described that in several different ways, but one way that he described it was talking about the four paramatta satya, the highest truths. One of those, the first one, is being called citta, and I've talked about that term before. But that means that there are a number of wholesome states and a number of unwholesome states and a number of neutral states which arise in the mind. So it's unwholesome consciousness, wholesome consciousness, neutral consciousness. So things like greed, things like hatred, things like envy, things like loving kindness, things like compassion, things like sympathetic joy with others. Excuse me. These are all states of mind, and they are fundamental. Whichever life you live, whether it's in this aeon or the next aeon or in previous aeons, the working of the human mind is the same. It lasts. It's beyond time, really. It's timeless. And the second one is cetasika. There are 52 of those, and they're all the things that go up to making your thought process, if you like. So the first citta is really, if you like, types of consciousness. The second is the rest of your mental components. And in there are things like mindfulness, there's things like, with every moment of consciousness that arises, there are seven of those cetasikas which occur with every single one of them. And so feeling is one, perception is another, contact, so sensual contact is light makes contact with the eye and the eye makes contact with the mind. There's contact. There is volition. So this is where karma is made. And this is also the 50 of those cetasika, 50 of the 52, or what we when we talk about the aggregates, the five aggregates, they're what consist of sankhara. So they are the bits of your mental being, if you like, that move, that fit together and cause you to have mood, to cause you to have thoughts, cause you to have certain types of feelings. And they all come together in a different way with each moment of consciousness. So there's another one which is manasikara, which is what directs the mind to the particular sense object. There's another one called jivit indriya in Pali, and that one is what gives life to everything. It's interesting. I don't actually know what the real way to interpret that is, but jivit indriya is. If anyone's a physicist, if they know what what particles mass. Yeah, it's what gives all particles mass. Well, jiva indriya is what gives all life to all moments of consciousness. That's the only way that I can describe how that works. And that in some commentaries, they actually say that even plants have jiva indriya. So plants are not just like a lump of rock, totally inert. They do have some characteristics. They grow and they reproduce. But in terms of having a mental component, obviously they're not the same as animals, but nevertheless. And finally, ekakata. So ekakata is a cetasika, is one of these mental components that works all the time. So as a moment of consciousness arises, ekakata means to be singular. Only one moment of consciousness can arise at any given time. So you can't see, hear, touch, taste simultaneously. But moments of consciousness arise and pass away so fast that it gives the illusion in the outside world, in the world of samudhi, in the world, the conventional world, it gives the illusion of the fact of you being able to sense things on multiple planes at the same time. The reality is you can't. The reality is only one occurs at any given point in time. That's cetasika. They're the mental components of a human being. And then there's form, and that's where karma's made also through volition in that cetasika. Then there's form, which is earth. It's the physical elements: earth, fire, water, air, space. And these are those elements describe particular features. So earth is things that are hard or soft. Water is things which glue things together, if you like. Water is what's the word I'm looking for? It binds things. And air is movement. Fire is hot and cold. So these are features which are universal. and they're fundamental. And then finally, there's Nibbana, which is freedom from suffering. It's the complete opposite of the other three. So the other three are all involved in suffering. Nirvana is free from suffering. It's a reality, but it's a reality unlike the other three, because it is free from suffering. And if that wasn't there, then there'd be no path, there'd be no way out. You'd be caught up in the realm of birth, old age, sickness and death forever. So it's only the fact that there is another alternate reality, if you like, which is not born, has no signs, there is no beginning, no end, it's beyond time, it's beyond space, it just is. And that's about the best you can say. There is no greed, no hatred, no delusion, no ignorance. And depending as to who you listen to or who you read, some will say that that state of Nibbana only arises when you actually overcome the defilements. And it's true that that's when you experience it. But if it only arose at that time, then it would be created. Because you would have created it at the time that you've extinguished the defilements. So that goes against the definition. The fundamental definition is it is beyond time, it is never created, and it never ends. So that view of the world where Nibbana is just the end of a process, I would argue is a wrong view. There are people who teach that, though. And so you can come across that, and I make no bones about it. I disagree with that. I can't see any logic in it. And when I say I disagree with that, one of the reasons why I disagree so strongly with that view is that it's not a view held by my teacher. So I go back again to where we started from, which is you need a teacher. Otherwise, what ends up with is you could end up with wrong view, even though you have good intention, and even though you may be interpreting the scriptures, and even though you may be interpreting your own experiences. If you don't have a good teacher, then you can end up with wrong view, despite all your best intentions. So I spoke really about that yesterday. So some of you who were here then, I apologize for duplicating the discussion. But basically, if you like, there are some fundamental building blocks which build up body and mind, and we totally are deluded about them. That's the state. That's the human state. And because we're deluded about them, we grasp for things which we cannot control. We desire things which we cannot control, and that through that desire we grasp them. When we grasp them, these things that are external to us, when we become entangled with them, when we become intoxicated by them, then because they are formed by causes and conditions which are beyond our control, when those causes and conditions change, then so too do those objects. And so they may pass away, they may die, they may break. And then we get upset. Because the other thing that we do in that whole process is we identify the first thing with the closest things to us, which is this body and this mind, our thoughts. We say, these are my thoughts, these are my feelings, this is my body, this is my food, this is my house, this is my car. And so we identify not just with things which we would say, yeah, okay, I'd like that, but it's not mine. But you still identify, you still differentiate between yourself and other things, other people and other objects. And that's part of the conventional world again. And if you are caught up in that net of delusion, which says this is true, this is the truth of existence, then you're doomed to suffer, because you're living in a world over which you have very little control. I mean, we say we can control our body, but we can't. We can't stop our hair from growing or falling out. We can't stop our nails from growing. We can't sit here. I can't sit here and say blood flow backwards. It won't. I can tell it all I like. It won't take any notice of me. So what we can control is limited. And because we can control things that we want to bring under our control, then we suffer. And that's the way of the world.
Can I just make one question from that? So there's a process whereby you step down into the state of meditation, where you step towards it, and if you don't learn how to get out of it, then you can go down into my tracks and get stuck.
That's correct.
So learning to get out is as best as a woman is learning to get in, or not in and out, but this is the coarse way of saying how you get to the point.
Yes.
Where you can understand. And there's a point where you have to un-understand so that you can escape the wrong roots.
That's true, but it applies particularly to certain kinds of individuals. When you practice and you become, you have strong concentration and you can enter a state that we call jhana, there are different levels of jhana. There are 8, depending as to, again, which text you read. 4 or 8. Some people don't like to recognize the last 4. But anyway, regardless of that, they're different, they're more subtle levels of concentration, of refinement. And Chelachan Tet used to, and the Thai forest tradition in general, talk about jhana as being a meditative state which interrupts the normal flow of consciousness. So the flow of consciousness, which we all know, sometimes called the life continuum, translated as life continuum. In Pali, it's a word called bhavanga. And the Thai teachers use that term quite a bit, Thelachan Tet in particular, more than most. But it's not a term that you find in the suttas too much. So the Lord Buddha hardly ever referred to the bhavanga. In the Abhidhamma, it's there a lot. And so you find there are a number of people who would say that the Lord Buddha didn't teach anything about the bhavanga, so therefore the interpretation that the Thai forest teachers have is wrong. Is heresy, if you like, but I find that a totally unacceptable argument for various reasons. But Thelachan Tet used to talk about when your mind becomes concentrated and drops into the bhavanga. The bhavanga itself is like a new world, and you can. There are three kinds of bhavanga. There's, I don't remember them now, Bhavangupada, which is the first state. Bhavangupada means, or effectively, that it just pops up. Have you ever sat in meditation and you sit there with your eyes closed and you're practicing and then suddenly you feel whoop, that your mind has just dropped and then shoots back again? If you've ever felt that, that is bhavanga. That's the instant, the instantaneous type of bhavanga moment, where the mind, so your meditation object just goes for a minute and just goes whoop, and you drop and you bounce back again, and then you're back to normal. Then there's bhavanga charana, which is the second one. And that lasts much longer, and that's what they call the bhavanga. The mind is surveying. So in this stage, you can look at meditation subjects and you can analyze them, but you're focused only on the meditation subject. You're not listening to things that are outside. You're not seeing things that are external to your meditation subject. Your mind is firmly planted on the meditation subject. And then there's the final one, which is bhavanga pajeta, which is the absolute shutting off of all sense perceptions. So you shut off from everything. even your own meditation subject is gone. Because what happens is when you concentrate on your meditation subject, if you like, there's the viewer and the observer and the observed. And the meditation subject is the observed. And what happens there is the mind drops the meditation subject and focuses on itself. So the observer and the observed become the same. And then Bhavanga. And so then all the other external things which impact on the Bhavanga cause it to cause thought processes and all of those sorts of things that follow on from sensory impingement. All of those things stop. But when you get there, depends, you can have totally unique experiences. So some people see lights. Some people have see other beings, heavenly realm beings, hell realm beings. That should be me saying shut up. I better turn it off myself. The experiences that you have, you can see visions. You can play, it's almost like a daydream in a sense. But it's interesting because once when I was practicing, I had this situation where my mind was quite concentrated, but my mindfulness was just too strong. And I knew, because having many conversations with Dhanajan Ted, I understood this myself. So I had to wind back mindfulness just a little bit, just ease off, being mindful of my meditation subject, and then went into jhana. And when I went into that, then this whole scene played out in front of me. And then one thing that happened was when I came out of that, not when I was actually in that state, because you can't really think of anything when you're in that state, I realized that by the quality of the vision that I saw, that it was telling me which jhana I was in, first, second, third, or fourth. And so the quality of the vision dictated was the signpost telling me which jhana I was in. So then I was so pleased with myself that I thought, right, I'll go and see Dhanajan and I'll tell him what I've experienced and tell him what I've concluded. And so I went to see him, I paid my respects and sat down and I explained to him what happened. And he chuckled to himself and with a bit of amusement. And he said, you know, when I was a young man, that's exactly how I learned how to understand which level of jhana I was in. But it's like you can almost have your own internal set of khandhas. You've almost got your own body. It's not a physical body, but it looks like one. And you've got your own thoughts and your own, your own experiences in that realm. And you can have all sorts of different experiences. Some are not always good. And that's also when you need to have a teacher who can guide you so that you can actually understand that what's happening to you and so that you don't get trapped by thinking that that's the best form of practice, because that state can be very joyful, very happy and just blissful. And so it's different for different people. And some people never see anything like that. They never have any visions. They just simply dwell in bliss. Or they dwell in complete equanimity, where neither there is bliss nor unhappiness. And that's fourth jhana. And that's just a state which usually people who practice and get to that level sustain for an hour or 2 hours, then come out and the mind is fully rested. And then it's a good time to investigate.
So I've gone over time.
So, I didn't know what to talk about, so now I've finished. So, so we'll practice meditation for a little while now. So I've said enough, so I'm definitely not doing a guided meditation. So pick your own meditation subject. Focus your attention on that subject. And we'll sit and make our minds quiet. now, coming close to the end of our meditation. Just ease your mind back to normal. Start to feel your body. Just come around in your own time. So, is that it? Is there anyone who wants to say or ask anything other than Phil? He's had his go. Okay. Over to Master of Ceremonies.
Now let us take the business of sharing in aspiration.
The goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all the harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all of these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Just before we go, just on that stanza, on that verse, a piece of advice: if you go meditating somewhere new, somewhere where you haven't been before, it's always a good idea to share merit. You don't have to chant the whole thing, but to share merit with all the beings that are in that area. And then that way, mischievous devas that are around that might want to interrupt your meditation will be pleased because you're sharing your merit with them and you want for them to be free from suffering too. So if you do go to a new place, like go and meditate in the cemetery, like Caspar and I used to do, then it's always useful then to bear those sharing of merit verses in mind, because it is something that we can do. We can share our merit, and it's meritorious for us to do so. It compounds our merit. When we give it away, we actually get more back than we give. So it's something to do, something useful to do every time you go somewhere new to meditate. Okay, thank you.